World Cup Talk. Christina here with the storylines that matter most in football today. Brazil's injury picture suddenly feels like the story that could bend the whole tournament. Rafinha's hamstring issue is the headline, because Brazil confirmed the problem, and now the timing of his return is genuinely uncertain. Add that to the endless Neymar conversation, which even drifted into politics and public jokes in Brazil, and you get something bigger than one medical update. You get a reminder that for a favorite, the World Cup can tilt not on tactics boards, but on muscle fibers and recovery timelines. What makes this worth talking about is not just the celebrity angle. Brazil built a lot of its attacking threat around speed, one-on-one pressure, and that feeling that a match can break open in 10 seconds. If Rafinha is limited, the shape changes. If Neymar is still being discussed more as a question than a certainty, the emotional pressure goes up too. Suddenly, every training session matters more, every lineup hint matters more, and the conversation around Brazil becomes less about style and more about whether the tournament is demanding too much, too quickly, from star players. I also think there is a wider World Cup theme here. Modern tournaments are brutally compressed, and the global audience expects every superstar to arrive fresh, explosive, and available every 3 days. That is fantasy. What we're seeing with Brazil is the real version. Medical caution, public impatience, and a team trying to project calm while everybody outside the camp starts doing knockout math. Another thread that jumped out over the last day is how seriously teams are treating heat. ESPN's reporting on European teams trying to beat World Cup heat is exactly the kind of story casual fans underestimate. Heat isn't just a background condition. It changes training intensity, rotation plans, hydration strategy, sleep quality, and even how coaches think about pressing. A team can look tactically brave on paper, and then become much more conservative if the physical cost is too high in the middle of a match. And that matters for listeners, because this is where tournament football gets really honest. The World Cup is sold as pure drama, but underneath it is logistics, physiology, and adaptation. The smartest teams are not just the most talented teams. They are the ones adjusting earliest. If one staff is planning cooling routines, travel timing, and energy conservation better than everyone else, that can be the difference between a flashy group stage performance and a deep run. I'm especially interested in how this shifts the balance between squads with huge depth and squads that rely on 11 or 12 trusted players. Heat punishes thin squads. It punishes emotional games where teams chase too hard too early. It punishes countries whose best identity is relentless pressing, but who may need to choose their moments more carefully. So when people say a tournament is becoming a test of management as much as talent, this is exactly what they mean. Then there is the political and travel story around Iran, which has become one of the most complicated off-field issues in this World Cup cycle. Reuters reported that the U.S. defended travel restrictions affecting Iran, with discussions still ongoing, and other outlets pushed the angle even harder. This is no small detail. Travel policy is not some abstract background issue when a team, its staff, and potentially its supporters are trying to move through a World Cup environment that is supposed to feel global and open. The football consequence is obvious. Any uncertainty around movement, accommodation, routines, or supporter access creates stress that richer federations are simply better equipped to absorb. The World Cup loves to call itself universal, but stories like this expose the uneven reality. Some nations are preparing around matchups and form. Others may also have to prepare around diplomatic friction, border questions, and the possibility that normal tournament rhythms don't apply to them in the same way. For fans, this becomes a test of what kind of event the World Cup wants to be. If the spectacle is global but the access is selective, people notice. And they should. A tournament is not just the 90 minutes on the pitch. It is also the ability of supporters to travel, gather, and actually create the atmosphere that makes the World Cup feel like the World Cup. On the fan side, I thought Reuters had a really useful counterpoint with its piece on how the United States is winning over visiting supporters through the welcome on the ground. That kind of story can sound soft, but it really isn't. Fan experience shapes the memory of a tournament almost as much as results do. Transport, hotel setups, security presence, street culture, volunteer energy, and whether supporters feel looked after, all of that becomes part of the event's reputation. What I like about that angle is that it complicates the easy criticism. Big tournaments always carry anxiety about pricing, infrastructure, distance, and commercialization. But when fans report that they feel embraced, that matters. It suggests the host experience is not defined only by ticket frustration or travel cost. It can also be shaped by hospitality, local curiosity, and the emotional payoff of being there. For the U.S. especially, where football culture is often judged from afar, this kind of feedback is valuable soft power. Still, there is no point pretending everything is smooth. Ticketing remains a live conversation, and Politico's report about the World Cup fueling demands for ticketing reform points to a familiar tension. Whenever an event becomes this big, access becomes political. Who gets the seats? Who absorbs the fees? Who benefits from resale systems? And how many ordinary supporters get priced out while the event markets itself with images of popular passion? This is where the World Cup can feel like two tournaments at once. One is the dream version on television, color, noise, flags, and stories. The other is the experience economy version, where fans are navigating costs, resale confusion, travel planning, and the suspicion that being emotionally invested is not enough unless you can also afford the premium version of attendance. Reform conversations matter because they go straight to the credibility of the spectacle. There is also a tactical side to all this commercial pressure. When attending becomes harder and more expensive, the crowd composition changes. Corporate attendance rises. Local access changes. The noise profile of a stadium can change. The spontaneous, chaotic, truly World Cup feeling can flatten out if the people who create it are the people least able to get in. That is not nostalgia. That is part of the competitive environment. One more thing from today's cycle. Beyond the giant headlines, a lot of team guides and match updates are appearing across outlets, and that tells you the tournament conversation is narrowing from broad anticipation into sharper identity questions. Who can adapt? Who has depth? Who is carrying an injury risk that has been underestimated? Which favorites are still being judged on brand more than current condition? Those are the better questions now. So if I had to sum up the day, I'd say the World Cup story right now is really about stress tests. Brazil are dealing with the stress test of superstar fitness. European teams are dealing with the stress test of climate and physical management. Iran are facing the stress test of politics colliding with sport. Hosts are facing the stress test of whether welcome, cost, and access can all coexist. That is the tournament in its truest form. Not just who plays beautifully, but who handles pressure most intelligently. And that's why today feels more interesting than a simple roundup of scores or fixtures. The biggest stories are the ones that tell us what this World Cup is becoming before the trophy is anywhere near decided. See you tomorrow.